This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Hey everybody, Double G here with the Death Lineup. Quick introduction for our latest episode, which features an interview with Sabrina Merchant, basketball writer for The Athletic. She covers WNBA, college basketball. She's really one of the top writers currently covering the sport and writing at one of the best places to read about the WNBA and women's basketball. We're going to have that interview here in a second, but I just wanted to kind of update on the Warriors themselves. So since we talked about Jimmy Butler, the Warriors are 3-1 since then. They beat the Bulls. They beat the Bucks. They lost to the Mavericks in kind of a funky game the other night, and I was pretty sure that they were going to get stomped by the Rockets, but they did not. They actually had a gigantic lead over the Rockets, only to have to hold on in true Warriors fashion, at least 2024-25 Warriors fashion, where they just sometimes cannot hold a lead to save. But they were also really tired from the night before. They had a really early game. You know, I don't know what the time frame was when they actually got to Houston, but it was an early tip for them. And Rockets were also coming off of a back-to-back, I believe. So not the greatest game, but it was one of those games that they kind of pulled it out in the end. Just a couple of old school vet moves by Draymond and Steph and Jimmy hitting free throws, and the Rockets, who, I mean, the Rockets were basically playing their bench as well near the end because their starters weren't doing it at all. So anyways, 3-1 since Jimmy Butler trade. Brian and I will be back thinking Monday. We'll see, because we're going to the All-Star festivities this weekend. On Saturday, we're heading over to San Francisco, the old Punchline, and The Ringer is having a podcast for Real Ones. Howard Beck, Logan Murdoch, Rajah Bell, they're going to do a live pod, and we're going to go hang out there, and then we're just going to see what's going on with All-Star Saturday. You'll hear in the interview with Sabrina, I mentioned Steph Curry and Sabrina Ionescu not shooting at the All-Star Saturday night, which is really sad. Like, that's really the thing that I was looking forward to. I'm not sure how many people are looking forward to the dunk contest after the last couple years, though I did like the dunk contest 2 years ago. I thought it was good. Last year, not so much. Three-point shootout, Dame, Buddy Hield, yay, I guess. It was really the Steph shooting with Clay, possibly against Caitlin and Sabrina. And then when Caitlin pulled out, I was happy with Steph and Sabrina again. You know, change it up, make the odds a little different. Maybe if Sabrina wins, Steph comes to shoot at the WNBA All-Star Weekend, something like that. That you could have done something really fun with it. And you'll hear in the interview with Sabrina, I mentioned Unrivaled, which is the women's 3-on-3 league, and how, from a marketing perspective, I'm really impressed with what they're doing. And man, this is All-Star Weekend. You can do literally anything you want, because it is just for fun. It is just an exhibition. and they don't want to pull the trigger on something really fun for the Bay Area. Like, what the heck is Steph going to do this weekend? He is kind of the celebrity of the weekend. He will play in the All-Star game, or this new sort of weird tournament style All-Star game, All-Star games. And then what else? The fans just want to celebrate this guy, and I'm sure he'll kind of walk out on the court and they'll give him a standing, but it's that we want to see him shoot. This is what he does. So I'm really disappointed in the NBA for not pulling the trigger on something that could have been fun. So also you'll hear in the show, in the interview, Brian and Sabrina talking about USC versus UCLA. UCLA undefeated, number one team in America for women's hoops, college hoops. And USC with Juju Watkins and Kiki Iriafin. We talk a lot about Kiki in this upcoming interview, by the way. And lo and behold, USC kind of runs away with the game there at the end, and they beat the no longer undefeated UCLA Bruins. They got out to an early lead, and then UCLA closed it by halftime. And when I started watching late in the second half, it was like a one-point game. And then Juju started blocking shots. They were getting layups on the other end. And I think UCLA just kind of got tired from their original comeback. So good stuff in the Sabrina interview. Like I said, I think Monday, Brian and I will come back. We'll talk more about the Jimmy Butler stuff and the current Warriors team. We'll talk a little bit about whatever goes on All-Star Weekend that we get a chance to see. And we'll wrap that up on Monday for hopefully Monday. So that's it for my intro. So the interview with Sabrina Merchant from The Athletic. We talk a lot about the WNBA draft specifically. We talk about the Valkyries roster, talk about Paige Bueckers, bunch of other stuff. So enjoy the interview with Sabrina Merchant. We have a very special guest to help us along our educational journey as it pertains to women's college and pro basketball, especially with there being new Golden State Valkyries news every other day, it seems. She writes about women's hoop for The Athletic and is also part of The Athletic's podcast on women's basketball, which is my go-to. She has a brand new piece on Lauren Betts that dropped just today, so go out and read that. Welcome, Sabrina Merchant. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
This is our pleasure here because we get to pick your brain. And you are somebody who, at least to me, like as I learn more about the sport, I've been reading you longer than I've probably been reading most other writers when it comes to women's basketball. So this is really cool for me, and I'm sure for Brian as well. But I just wanted to ask the first question because it's so timely. Mm-hmm. There was a report today that the very heavily rumored shoot-off between Stephen Curry and Klay and Caitlin and Sabrina, and then Caitlin pulled out. Mm-hmm. And so we still thought that something was going to happen, but just today the news came out that they just dropped the whole thing. What happened there? What do you think went on with the reasoning behind that?
Well, I'm with you. I was so excited about the double format, you know, especially when the rumor was that Klay would be joining and Caitlin would be joining, and whatever duos they ended up using in that combination, I think would have been fun regardless. But I like you, assumed that when Caitlin dropped out, that another WNBA player would be able to step in, whether that's like Kelsey Plum, you know, who was just recently introduced with the Sparks, or like, I don't know, any of the many players who are in Unrivaled right now who just like could take some time for the weekend. But I guess when, I don't know, I think the idea was that last year's was such a fun moment, right? Like Sabrina coming off of the 37-point round in the WNBA three-point shootout, and to try to just do it again, I guess, seemed stale. I don't know, but it just seems silly to me that like no WNBA player would want to take part. And I don't know how hard they looked beyond like the surface level of WNBA names. So maybe that's what happened.
Was it Alicia Gray that just won it for the WNBA?
Yes, she just won last year.
Yeah, see, that would have been my go-to for the
And she's already going to be at All-Star. She's in the celebrity game.
Oh. So. Yeah, that would have been an easy one. That was my favorite event. So I think Saturday night for the NBA especially has just like not been that entertaining for like 6 years now, maybe more. And that was like the fun moment. So that is a bummer.
Yeah, it's funny. Like they released the names of the NBA 3-point shootout this year, and they're like, yeah, Dame Lillard's going for his third in a row. And I was like, Dame was in the 3-point shootout last year. Like, I have no recollection of this.
And they kind of shoehorned Buddy Hield from the Warriors into it, who is, you know, historically a great shooter, but is not shooting well at all this year. And it's kind of, if you ask Warriors fans, is maybe not on the fan favorite list for players this year. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's a shame. It was a good time. And I think one of the best ways that they've been able to integrate WNBA players into NBA All-Star. Like, I was always a big fan of the Shooting Stars event. I don't know if you remember, like, during the mid-2000s, right, where they had, like, one retired, one W, one NBA player. And I don't know why they got rid of that, but that might be a fun thing to bring back if they want to just, you know, keep the brother-sister thing going as long as possible between the two leagues.
So I think moving on here to the draft, you put out a mock draft here last week, and that's kind of like the next thing for Valkyries fans is we've had our expansion draft. We've had the free agency. We got Tiffany Hayes. Sure, we were expecting maybe a bigger splash, but hey, we'll take the sixth player of the year. But the next thing on the agenda here is the draft, and we have the fifth pick in the draft and in your mock draft. And I was able to find two online on, this is a different gripe I have to pick with The Athletic, but I typed in WNBA mock draft on The Athletic search, and I had it under the article tab, and none of your pieces even came up. It was so I just went to the author tab, Sabrina, and then I would go down from there. But I've had that issue with The Athletic's app for a little bit now, but you guys, you had us selecting Kiki Iriafen from USC with the fifth pick of the draft. And then I was also able to find one that I think happened right after the draft lottery,
right,
November 18th, and you had us taking Georgia Amor. So I was wondering, to me, it kind of seems like the draft starts at 3. It seems like everyone basically has Paige 1, Olivia 2, I guess barring any trades, but that kind of seems like the top 2 right now. If somehow we were to get to number 3, we being the Valkyries, if the Valkyries were able to get to number 3, who do you think they'd select?
Yeah, I don't really have a great sense of what the Valkyries are trying to accomplish here in year one because, you know, I wrote about this after the expansion draft, that it seemed like they were drafting a team during the expansion draft that was like built to surround a star. Like, it was all complimentary players, right? Veteran role players who kind of, you know what you're going to get with them. Maybe not a ton of upside, like other than like the Kate Martins and like Ileana Repairs of the world. But it definitely seemed like they were trying to like create a team that could supplement like a Jewel Lloyd or a Kelsey Plum or, you know, insert all-star who happens to sign with the Valkyries during free agency. And admittedly, that didn't happen. Like, Tiffany Hayes is a former all-star, but I wouldn't say that she's at that point of her career in the moment, right? So I don't really know if like the Valkyries want to select somebody who maybe is going to stay in Europe for one more year and you don't even get to have them on your inaugural team. Or do they want to select somebody who, like, this is our rookie, this is our first draft pick, and you're going to love them immediately, and they're going to be the person that we market around, and like, this is going to be a good selling point for us in year one of the Valkyries franchise. So, like, if they want to just go long term, like, we don't really care if this player is going to be here in 2025, they should select Dominique Belonga. I think she is the highest upside, the most potentially talented player, 6'6" center out of France. She was on the Olympic team last year. She's only 19 years old. Maybe has turned 20 actually, but relatively young, you know, especially compared to the college draft prospects that you're going to get. And she's just super athletic, really toolsy. Like, the jump shot's still a work in progress, but she can defend a variety of positions. And I think just a league like the WNBA, where it's so important to have a really quality four, you know, a really quality front court player to build your team around, that seems like the kind of player you'd want going forward. It's just like, is she going to come to the W in 2025? There's Eurobasket this year. France presumably will be a part of it. She'll have to leave at least for 10 games. France usually likes to have their players for a long time before these international competitions. So, like, would she even be able to come over before that? And then it's a whole thing of, like, you know, do you really want to start off your big, splashy inaugural first year with a player who's just not there? And I don't envy that position because, like, it's really hard to balance the long-term arc of your franchise with, hey, like, we're building something new here, and it'd be nice if people were here to see it and be part of it. So I think if we're just like, you know, building this like on a spreadsheet and like not thinking about marketing or any of that, I believe Dominique Malanga is the best possible pick for this franchise, whether that's at 3, whether that's at 5, you know, whatever. I do love the idea of Georgia Amor though for the Valkyries, and she kind of not necessarily the same high upside play, right? Like she is a smaller guard. She's only 5'6", but she is a point guard with a, you know, predilection for long distance shooting, like a really good organizer of an offense, has been running a pro offense, I would say, under Kenny Brooks for like the last 4 years of her college career. And frankly, it's too easy for me to like make the Steph Curry comparisons, right? Like a guard who can just like pull up from long range and like can excite the fan base in a way that I think is kind of necessary, you know, for year one of a franchise. So I like her a lot, you know, whether that's 3, whether that's 5, you know, for the Valkyries, because I think it just kind of helps when you have a good point guard to build things around. Maybe that's less of a necessity now that Tiffany Hayes is signed with the Valkyries, but those are the two players who I kind of had my eye on originally. Kiki Arifin, I think if they end up, you know, staying at 5 and not being able to move up to 3 makes a lot of sense because of her Northern California ties too. And again, just going back to the whole, like, this is a league of power forwards, but I would say like those three players, probably the Malanga and Amors of the world, if you're going to move up to 3, make the most sense to me.
By the way, and this is not to embarrass Brian in any way, but because of some of the free agent pickups, the Valkyries have Brian doing like YouTube streams of like French national games right now.
Oh yeah,
that's how dialed he is into this stuff. But I'll let Brian get to that because I just wanted to mention one more thing about Kiki because, you know, we were talking to writer Michelle Smith about this, who has Bay Area ties. She actually works in Silicon Valley at San Jose State, and we were kind of talking about like the Bay Area being the giant area that it is, really good media market. How does Joe Lacob want to present the face of the franchise? We know with the free agency stuff, like who knows who's going to be here and who's going to move on. And there's going to be so much movement, especially next year, to line up big deals. And so if you can get a Kiki Arifin, who did play majority of her career in Stanford, coming out party last year in the tournament, like I feel like he would probably try to move mountains to get her if she is available anywhere near them, just for the mere fact that he can just put her in every marketing thing that they have, and it's an easy sell to this area because we got to see her.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a nice marketing plug too. I don't actually think they would need to move up to 3 to pick Kiki Arifin, frankly. That's nothing against her. I just think the way the draft's going to work with like Chicago and Washington both already having a lot of young bigs and not necessarily needing to take another one. So that might be able to work in their favor, right? Like you don't have to make a big push. She could just land in your lap and it'd be a nice, you know, wholesome outcome for everybody.
Yeah, going back to what you said, I have questions about Georgia, about Dominique and Kiki. So I think I'll start with the Georgia one because you thought that, you know, maybe if we were at 3, we would still select her. I kind of had more of a question along the lines of like basketball, like the WNBA philosophically, because I, of course, this is a Warriors podcast. There's an NBA background, and I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but I looked up the average height of an NBA player and it's 6'6". And then I looked up the average height of a WNBA player and it's 6 foot. So normally I'm just like, okay, for my head, like, a 5'6 WNBA player could equate to a 6 foot NBA player. Mm-hmm. And in the NBA, those players have kind of phased out. It's more so like 6'2, 6'3 is the shortest guard now. It is really like just blessed with natural talent and like the will, then you have a chance.
Chris Paul side-eyed you right now, by the way.
He's the last one. Trae Young, and I think like both Jones brothers, like Tyus and Trae Jones, are like what. And then I think there's a Japanese player on the Memphis Grizzlies. But anyway, do you think like the 5'6 point guard for the WNBA is here to stay? And I know that one of the best ones is still coming up in Hannah Hidalgo, and I think she'll be a hit no matter what in the WNBA. But I guess past her, talking about Georgia, talking about, I think Rory Harmon's 5'6 as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that type of archetype is like here to stay as the league progresses in the next 5 years?
No, I don't think so. I think this is an anomalous situation, and the height is you know, truthfully a huge concern to me, because I think about players like Crystal Dangerfield, who was Rookie of the Year in 2020 as a 5'6" point guard and hasn't really been able to carve out a career since then, just because there's a lot of defensive limitations when you're that size. And I think I'm just looking at this draft, and other than the international players, who, again, there's an inherent amount of risk just with their availability and how their games are going to translate if they come to the W. I'm not sure that there's like anyone with the star power of Georgia Amor beyond her. And so I'm willing to just kind of take a risk on her upside, knowing that, yeah, she's a little small, but also this is a type of player who has been getting ready to be a pro player basically since she got to Virginia Tech like 5 years ago. You know, the way she finishes around the rim, it's all like, you can see like the ways that she angles herself. It's not because of what the defense is doing to her. It's because what she's expecting like an actual WNBA defender would be doing to her, right? Like the side steps that she takes on her threes to get space, like everything has been with the goal of like, when I see pro style defenders, how am I going to be able to account for that? Like, and I'm trying to do that starting now, even though like everybody in the ACC isn't capable of necessarily defending her that way. So I just believe that like she has a certain understanding of how to play point guard, and point guard is actually like low-key a really not deep position in the WNBA. Like, it's really hard to find a good point guard. So if you can get a player who could potentially be like an anchor for you at that position for a good amount of years to come, who again has like the jump shooting ability, has the flair, I think that's part of it, right? Like, she's just kind of a fun player to watch. She gets her teammates involved and just brings a lot of excitement to the floor. Like, you know, I mean, like, this is an entertainment product, right? Like, we want, you know, things should be fun to watch. It should be bringing joy to the court, right? And I think Georgia just has that innate ability to like run a team and this magnetism while she's doing it. And I have a hard time like looking away from all that. And the fact that she's led really successful teams like for the past 4 years, right? And going from, you know, the continuity of Virginia Tech to following Kenny Burst to Kentucky. And yeah, she's running the same offense, but she has almost an entirely new set of teammates to work with. And it still has flowed like tremendously. So I agree with you about the height thing. And honestly, I think it's an even bigger concern on the W side, because like the range of outcomes in the W is a little bit smaller, right? Like 6 inches is like more standard deviations than it would be in the NBA, you know? So I agree that that's definitely something to like be concerned about. It's just, I look at the prospects below and I'm not overwhelmed by the potential star quality like that you'd be missing out on if you took Georgia Amor at that spot. So that's also part of it for me.
Okay, so I guess then capitalizing on like the star quality, because of, so I guess the next player kind of seems like the consensus 4 or 5 prospect is Dominique Malanga. And because so many of the Valkyries are like on like the French national team for the Eurobasket qualifier games, now Janelle Salon, who, by the way, I think looks awesome.
Yeah.
Ileana Rupert and Carla Leite. Like, I've been trying to watch some of those games, and because of that, I've gotten to watch some Dominique Malanga, and my goodness, like, I was just very, like, blown away with, of course, the size, and I feel like she has really good defensive instinct and defensive awareness, and then even the potential shooting ability for, like, someone her size. Like, I think of, and, like, I guess this will kind of show of how recently I started watching women's college basketball, but kind of what comes to my mind is, you know, that 6'7", like really dominant player in the paint, being like a Camila Cardoso or a UCLA, Lauren Betts.
Yeah.
And when I think of those players, like, I think they're amazing players, but they can't shoot the three. And it's made me way more like thinking like Jonquel Jones, like one of the best players in the WNBA, because she can do that and also be that amazing presence inside the paint. And so just the fact that Dominique is like even trying that ability of hers to shoot from the three, I don't know how good it's been. I've seen her hit a couple in games, but I guess my question is, you know, Lauren presumably might be the number one pick next year. Camilla was, you know, number four last year. Like, these are players who, you have a 6'7" player with any type of basketball skills, great hands, like they're going to be really good and go high in the draft. My question is like, why isn't Dominique like maybe the kind of just consensus like number two with her size and kind of abilities that she's shown so far?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say it's just international bias, frankly. You know, we're more familiar with players in the collegiate game for a league like the WNBA that has historically like had to work a little bit harder to market its own players to get that built-in advantage from college is something that's just hard to steer away from, right? Like, it's institutional knowledge, right? Like, we take the biggest college stars and we try to make them pro stars, and that's how, you know, we keep the machine going. I realize that's not necessarily like the best way to think about things all the time, because the worldwide basketball is expanding, and obviously France gave the USA a hell of a time in the gold medal game at the Paris Olympics. But I think a lot of it is just inherent bias, right? Like, this is how we think of the draft. It's, we look at the best college prospects and like we only think of international. Like, there's nobody really in the college world that makes sense at this particular spot. I think so when we think about the draft, like dating back to the lottery, it was just a lot of teams in that's in those slots all have the young bigs, right? Like, the Sparks were in that spot to begin with, right? And with Chicago and Washington also in the lottery, like, it was just, why would any of these teams want to draft another young big when they have Ali Edwards and Cameron Brink and Camilla Cardoso and all these other players, right? Now that like Seattle has moved in, I think there's more of a conversation about, okay, what could they potentially use? Like, they could theoretically draft a younger big for the future because their front court players are a little bit older, right? With Neko Gumake in her 30s already. I think a lot of it's just availability, right? Like, there is a history of players on the French national team having to commit a lot of time during the summers to the national team, more so than other national teams. And because the French league plays longer than other leagues, it's harder to get them to the WNBA for the start of the season, which is complicated even further by the prioritization rules, which Gabby Williams has, you know, dealt with for the last three seasons. So I think it's just a combination of factors. Like, the, for whatever reason, being French is like the biggest disqualifier to being a WNBA player, right? Like, because of the national team, because of the league. I think that's just like some inherent bias against that. And
yeah,
I really do believe that's what it is, because when you look at the quality of her as a prospect, like, there's no denying that she should be in that number two spot just logically, but because of the, you know, extracurricular factors, I think that's what moves her further down the draft board.
Yeah. And looking at like the Valkyries roster right now, there's like, of course you've said it on a podcast, there's a clear like international, I don't know if intentional focus, but there are a lot of international players that even competed in these European, the Eurobasket qualifier games, like Julie Van Loo. They just, I think her last name is Linskins.
Yeah, Kiara Linskins, the Belgian big, right? Who's apparently Julie's best friend. So
yes, kudos. Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, and again, I think that's a training camp contract that she might not even make the final 12. But even so, like, I looked at the schedule and I looked up when Eurobasket is and we have a home stretch when that's happening. And so presumably the most watched game for the Valkyries this season is going to be one of two games. It's going to be either their first game of the season or the Caitlin Clark game. And Caitlin Clark is coming to the Bay while Eurobasket is happening.
Oh no. So
they're going to be missing, you know, Rupert, Salon, Carla. I don't even know if Carla's going to come, but Julie. So that is going to be like, if they do select Dominique, like, Joe Lacob's going to be like, wait, none of my roster is here while Caitlin Clark is here. And that's going to, and I think there's a Liberty game in there as well. So that timing is pretty rough for them. And do you, I guess this wasn't one of the questions I wanted to ask, but now I guess now that I'm thinking down this road, do you think anything's going to change in terms of scheduling to, like, I mean, of course not this year, but just in general, if the WNBA schedule, like, allowing for more of, I don't know, just moving stuff around. Like, I've heard about this prioritization rule, and I've heard that Europe, international players aren't as, like, they feel like it's like an American rule, and they're not as pleased with how it's going right now with that.
Yeah, so I think we can just start with the prioritization rule, which came into effect during the 2020 CBA, and essentially says that if you are playing overseas during the offseason, you have to be back by the start of training camp, or else you are not eligible to sign with the WNBA team that year. And as you mentioned, it's kind of like disqualifying for foreign players who play in leagues that last a little bit longer, maybe want like a slight break before coming over, you know, and if they happen to play for a really good team whose calendar lasts longer, then that, you know, runs into conflict with the start of the WNBA season. And to the EuroLeague's credit, like, they've tried to shorten their seasons or at least move them up so that they don't conflict with the start of WNBA training camp. It's really only the French league that has a conflict now. And it still seems like it's something that's, I mean, it's designed to prioritize the WNBA and prioritize the American league. And obviously that is with the intent of bringing American players over, but it's sort of had like this chilling effect on foreign players wanting to come, because it seems like there's even less, the WNBA is becoming like sort of less welcoming to them. Right. But as far as the Eurobasket situation, like I don't see a way around it. Like at least the WNBA allows its pro players to go and play in these tournaments, mm-hmm. right? Like the NBA does not do that. The NBA doesn't even allow its American players to play in Olympic like qualifiers and American Cup things during the course yep. of the regular season, right? They have like a G League squad essentially that does that and plays those qualifying tournaments. So I think there is an understanding between the WNBA and international basketball that these international tournaments are important. We're not going to get in the way of them, right? Like they take the whole month off for the Olympics. They end the season early for the World Cup, you know, in those every 4 years. They can't also make a break for Eurobasket after mm-hmm. making a break for the Olympics, right? It would be unreasonable, especially since the majority of players are not involved in Eurobasket, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Golden State is obviously can be very affected by Eurobasket, but the majority of teams will have maybe one or two players who are in that situation.
Got it.
Yeah. Unfortunately for the Valkyries, it's going to suck. And I do believe that the international focus was intentional. Like their assistant general manager was just the president of the London Lions, has a long international track record. But yeah, it's going to suck for the Valkyries. Like there's just no getting around it. And it's just too bad that it happens to be in their first season.
Yeah. Okay. So do you have a question?
Well, I was just going to follow up and say, you know, you mentioned the 2020 CBA. Mm-hmm. I thinking of the NBA and the globalization of the NBA, and we can even look at Major League Baseball, like the biggest superstar in Major League Baseball is Japanese born. And so the Dodgers, I don't know what the Japanese market looks like as far as American baseball is concerned, but whatever that looks like they have it. The Dodgers have it.
Especially after this offseason too.
Right. With Sasaki and we're Giants fans. So our hearts are very broken by yeah. that. As we get to the future, how much are they looking at fixing those situations to embrace the globalization, knowing that how the NBA embraced it, and now, you know, out of the top 10 players, like probably half of them or more are not US born, and that enhances the game mm-hmm. If you are actually looking for the best players.
Yeah, I think in the 2020 CBA, it was sort of a concession from the players that they had to give to the owners in order to get more money and more benefits was, okay, we'll make this league a bigger priority because so many of them were literally coming back to the WNBA 2 weeks after the season had already started, like not getting to any of training camp. And it really just diminishes the product at the start of the year, right? And you think about when the buzz is biggest for the WNBA, it's, oh, like we're getting all these commercials during the NBA playoffs. The NCAA tournament has just ended. Here's the draft. Tune in for our big opening night doubleheader. And it's like, well, Kayla McBride's still in Turkey and the Feast of Collier is still away. And what are we actually advertising, right? If not the very best that we can. So I understood the logic in, you know, wanting to have everybody in market on their teams for the start of the season. I do think that the penalty is probably going to be a little bit less severe in the new collective bargaining agreement where, you know, there's still probably like will be a fine if you report late or, you know, maybe I think a fine is probably as heavy as it'd have to go, but not like restricting a player from playing altogether that season. Like that seems a little bit too onerous in my opinion, but I do understand like just wanting to have as much of your, not 144 anymore, but as much of your like 156 in market as possible, like when the season starts, like that makes sense to me. The thing is like with the international calendars, the international players, it's always been a sacrifice for them to come over, right? Because like the only way that you're going to make the WNBA more attractive to them than playing at home is just to give them so much more money. And the league is just not there yet, right? Like I think that's what works for the NBA from a globalization perspective is like, it behooves, you know, Nikola Jokic to play in Denver versus Megalux because he's making $50 million with Denver versus whatever contract he was making, you know, in Europe. And that's just not the case for Emma Mieseman or, you know, insert European all-star here. So I think it's not so much the prioritization rule. It's just the only way that they can make this a globally attractive league is for them to throw out the money that the Russian leagues did or the Chinese leagues do, or, you know,
how far apart are we talking about?
I mean, they're making seven figures easily, you know, the best players in Europe, and the maximum contract in WNBA right now is $250,000. So for you to one play year round, because you're not getting a break if you play in Europe and then in the WNBA, and then two, like spend your summer away from home. Like that just, that kind of sucks, right? So it's got to be a huge financial incentive, I think. And maybe that manifests itself in like a designated player rule, you know, sort of like what MLS has, right? Where you can break the salary cap a little bit to just bring in somebody, usually like one of those older players from a European league. But I do think that I wouldn't necessarily blame prioritization for not getting as many European players. I think it's just a financial cost. Yeah.
I guess now kind of talking about, because I think there's the CBA that's re-upping as well as the media TV deal, like on the same year. And do you have like any idea what maybe the max contract could shoot to from 250? Like, do you have like a range of numbers? And because I think of like the 2016 NBA offseason, and I'm so sorry to Evan Turner because I always use his name when I bring this up because he started making like a ginormous amount of money when, you know, he shouldn't have been. But that's like, that's kind of the expected jump I'm anticipating is just like something crazy like that. But do you have like a range of numbers from like the last time this happened, maybe to give any type of indication?
So, the CBA that came into effect in 2020 essentially doubled the maximum salaries. So it went from a little over 100 to like 210, and it's grown steadily just with cap rises over the last 5 years. So I would expect a significantly bigger jump this time around because of the magnitude of the TV deal and all of the sponsorship money that has come into the WNBA since. I'm expecting seven-figure max salaries at this point. Like, I don't really see a reason why like the finances wouldn't support that at this point. Unfortunately for the Evan Turners of the world, we're not really going to get those because all of the good players are, sorry, I phrase that really poorly. All of the all-star players are also free agents. So they're going to command the big contracts and like, you know, everybody I think will be like properly scaled.
True. Yeah. I forgot. Yeah. Everyone's going to be a free agent after this, barring like a few players on the rookie contracts. Speaking of, do you think that, I said this to Michelle Smith a couple weeks ago, but it is so frustrating that I cannot like find like eligibility that easily for college athletes. And I was saying like, there is a website, but I have to be like Olivia Miles to like know my own eligibility. Like I can't just like type in her name and find it. I guess two-party question then. One, outside of Paige and Olivia, do you know if any of the other top first round picks that are playing collegiate basketball that are expected to maybe declare for the draft still have remaining eligibility? And two, do you think they're going to forego that to maybe, because I think Olivia Miles is the perfect example for this because she is projected number two pick, but also next year, I imagine if she was to stay for one more year, you know, next year you have Lauren Betts, Flage, Taniya Latson, and Kiki Rice and Janiyah. Like, I feel like Olivia could probably still be top four, top five potentially if she was to take her last year of eligibility and then go back. And then, you know, you're talking about, you said from a 250K max salary to now, you know, seven figures. And then from the rookie scale contract, you know, I think it's top four picks each all make like the same. And then there's the next one of like 4 to 10, I think, picks make the same. Like, what would stop? Like, wouldn't it be kind of smart for her to stay for one more year, presumably to make so much more money in her rookie scale contract for next year? I know there's no guarantees.
Right. Just from talking to agents, most of them seem to be advising their clients, like if they have another year of eligibility, to take it and stay in college for one more year because of the huge financial windfall that, you know, could come for them in 2026 versus getting into the draft now. You know, it's different for somebody like Paige Bueckers, who has an enormous like off-court portfolio and will probably be doing just fine financially. And like, I mean this with all due respect, it's a little embarrassing to play 6 years in college. So maybe she doesn't want to do that. But I could see Olivia Miles like heavily considering it, especially if it means like one more year of playing with Hannah Hidalgo at Notre Dame. And for her, it's kind of a natural fifth year, right? Like, she had a full year of injury. So just playing out her medical redshirt year is something that's like very normal in college athletics, right? You know, we have a few players in this draft who have already used the fifth year, like Georgia Amor has. I think Maddie Westfeld from Notre Dame has already used her fifth year. Tahina Pau-Pau from South Carolina. A couple of the players who like could still play another year. AZ Fudd has another year of eligibility because of her medical redshirt.
Yep.
Thinking about, let's see now, Anissa Morrow would have to go pro.
Kiki has to go pro, right?
Kiki Erifan has to go pro. That's true. Yeah. I'm just looking at like the big board I had at the start of the year.
Any of the NC State guards?
No. So Sanaya Rivers and Isaiah James would both have to go pro. I guess like Raven Johnson from South Carolina, she technically has a fifth year because she has an injury redshirt year too.
Got it.
But,
so it's kind of just like knowing those, like who has the injury redshirt. Yeah, we're done with the COVID year, right?
Right. And then the WNBA draft eligibility works that if you're a junior who is turning 22 the year of the draft, you can declare early. So like we've seen this in the past with Jewel Lloyd and Jackie Young. Flaje Johnson could declare early this year. Mm-hmm. Janiyah Barker could. Lauren Betts could. But again, all of them are in situations where probably makes sense to just stick out the fourth year in college and get back. Although then, you know, like you mentioned, you're kind of getting into a really deep 2026 draft class. And ordinarily, I would think that would be a problem because it would make it less likely for you to stick on a team. But we're adding two teams to the league next year, so there'll be enough roster spots so that it shouldn't be a problem, I think. So if you're like, you know, I mean, Lauren Betts is not going to have a problem regardless. But, you know, other players of that, you know.
I think, I feel like it. Because yeah, that would have been my next question, and I think you kind of answered it already. But someone like AZ Fudd, who I feel like also has like a pretty big off the court portfolio, like what about for her? Where you know she has another year, and I think she's going to take that year based on what I've seen. But say like Olivia and a few of the other players you mentioned take that year and go into the next draft, and now that draft class is like pretty loaded. And then from AZ's perspective, I assume she's still going to be like a first round pick, but maybe some teams are worried about the injury and she falls down a couple rounds. Well, not only like, are you going to make more money in that next year, but also just from like round one to round two to round three, just the prioritization of a team for that player, they're going to have, you know, more leeway for a first round pick than they do a second round pick. Can you see someone like a AZ or a Janiyah saying like, you know what? I think we'd be a second round pick in the 2026 draft. Sure, we'll make more money, but in the 2025 draft, we'll be a first round pick. So maybe we should just declare early and have teams like, you know, favor us more as opposed to if we waited another year. Is that even a, you know, a scenario you could potentially see happening?
I mean, it's an interesting hypothetical. I would just say that WNBA teams are not super attracted. I'm not super attached to their first round picks. Like you look at what happened with the 2023 draft, right? And a lot of players used an extra year of eligibility to stay till 2024. So we saw a super deep 2024 draft, right? And that meant that 2023 was a little bit weaker. So players who might not have been drafted in the first round ended up going in the first round. And what happened? Zai Cook got waived. Letitia Amir, number 8 pick, got waived. Grace Berger, number 7 pick, got waived. Stephanie Suarez, number 4 pick, got waived. Like, just because they expended a number, a first round pick on them does not mean that they're more invested in their success, I think. If you're a good player and you find a good spot, I think that's probably a better option than just trying to, you know, jumpstart your pro career.
I wanted to quickly, because I do want to ask you some non-draft questions, and you've been great with time, so we don't want to take up too much of your time. But I have a friend, Jonathan Messenger, who wanted me to tell you you're his favorite writer about the WNBA. But I asked him if he had any questions. And so it was sort of similar to what we were talking about Paige. Is there real apprehension that she may be dissatisfied by getting drafted by Dallas, even outside of eligibility stuff, but just the Dallas franchise?
I think there is. You know, the Wings haven't had the most stable history, right? They've gone through head coaches basically every two seasons since they moved to Dallas. Recently, a change in the front office structure with Kurt Miller taking over for Greg Bibb. They have a history of players asking out after a couple seasons, right? Like Alicia Gray demanded a trade. Alicia Gray, who seems truthfully like the nicest, most easygoing star in the WNBA. And even she was like, no, I got to get out of here. Marina Mabry, Sathu Sabali, like a lot of people spend time there and then quickly decide like, no, this is not the place for me. So I think, you know, that's part of it. I've also spoken to some people who have suggested that like the political climate in Texas is not super attractive to Paige, just like with the scaling back of women's rights, not really a place that she wants to be. So, you know, I obviously not every WNBA market is going to satisfy those conditions for her, but, you know, California, Washington, Nevada seem like, you know, more attractive just off the top of my head than I would say Texas. But yeah, I think there are a number of concerns just with the history of the franchise, the fact that it's still in a market that, like, you know, they don't have, they have just announced the practice facility and moving to a downtown arena, but like historically hasn't provided the same player experience that some other franchises have across the WNBA. There's just a lot of things that go into it. And the fact that, you know, the history of the Wings has been players wanting out rather than wanting in just doesn't do the Wings a lot of favors.
So I wanted to ask, so now we've asked about just going back to the draft now, we've asked about, you know, Georgia, Dominique, and now Kiki is who I want to ask about. That's around about the 3 to 5 range that have been in your mocks. She's kind of like my like college women's basketball history kind of goes to a Arizona versus Stanford game, because I went to Arizona and I was watching Ari McDonald versus Ailey Jones, and of course my heart was broken. But Kiki, when I started to try and get into college women's basketball last year, I watched the Iowa State game and I was like, holy moly, in the tournament where she had like 40 something against them. Cam Brink fouled out, and I kind of picked her as my favorite player because I knew the Valkyries were coming in next year. I knew that she was probably going to go top two. I thought for a chance that maybe we would be like a lottery pick. But anyway, I like will watch those highlights like once every 2 months just to be like, this was awesome. And I actually watched them today before this podcast. And I was like, okay, not to like take any stock away from those highlights, but I watched them with a different perspective. Now knowing more about the teams and the players and Iowa State, and her game plan was kind of like, she gets the ball like about at the free throw line and she faces up and she assesses, is Audie Crooks too far away from me? Okay, jumper. Is Audie Crooks going to push up against me? Okay, I'm taking her to the rim because I'm quicker than her. Is there someone else on me other than Audie Crooks? It's going to be way smaller. I'm taking them to the rim. And so she was able to go crazy. But now, you know, we watch her at USC, and I don't think it's like the of course, completely different offense with, you know, Juju handling the ball a lot. And we're not seeing like the same, like get the ball at the free throw line, size up and make a decision and have more of a spread floor. And I just like wonder, like I watched, you know, during that tournament, I think I heard Ruoko maybe even compare her to like potentially like Asia. And then this year during in the Paris game against Ole Miss, I think it was, she took a fadeaway. And I think Ruoko or someone said, that looks like Nafisa Collier. So she has, since watching her, I've seen her get compared to who I believe are the two best players in the WNBA. And this is a league that's dominated by power forwards, them two, Alyssa Thomas, Breonna Stewart. And so I just think that like, she could, you know, maybe be of that esque. Like you watched those players coming up in college. And I was wondering, since I did not, did they kind of have these road bumps that, you know, Kiki's, I think, still having a great year on paper, but I just feel like I'm not seeing that potential star power that I saw in that one game. Of course, there's only one game, but I thought what I saw was just incredible. Did those players kind of have like a, were they just like greatness right from the start?
Yeah, unfortunately, my women's college knowledge is not as deep, you know, as my W experience has been. So I'm not terribly familiar with like Nafisa Collier as she was in college, or even Asia Wilson for that matter. I mean, it's kind of the fan that like just popped in for the Final Four games, you know, so
that's how I am.
Just to get a sense of who we're going to watch, you know, in the WNBA in a month's time. But I will say that, you know, having really zoned in on Kiki, the offensive context at USC just has not been as like productive for her as it was at Stanford, where she was playing next to a big and Cameron Brink who could space the floor, and Rhea Marshall just cannot do that. And you've noticed a lot of USC's just immediate adjustment has been, okay, we're going to play Kiki at the five, spread the floor, give her the space to, you know, like you mentioned, size up the defense at the free throw line, whether that's a little face up game, whether that's, you know, driving, posting, whatever. I think the decisiveness that you mentioned from that Iowa State game is something that has consistently stood out to me with Kiki, is that she doesn't waste a lot of time with her motion. Like she knows what she's going to do. It's just that the floor isn't always spaced for her to do what she wants to do at USC this season. So that's, I think, not necessarily like her fault. It's just a matter of who you're going to play her next to. And I think the bigs that are on the Golden State roster right now, like a lot of them have spacing capabilities. So maybe that makes more sense for a player like Kiki Iriafen. I just don't think that she has like the same number one scorer like upside that I thought, you know, coming out of that Iowa State game. It was... I think about that Stanford team a lot, and there was just nobody who could score on that group other than Cameron, Kiki, and then we get Hannah Jumko in every once in a while. So it was a lot of responsibility shouldered on her, and I think that made it look like she was capable of putting up bigger numbers when she seems to be more of like a complimentary offensive player, which is not a bad thing. Like she's a very good complimentary offensive player, just not, I think, the same go-to scorer as all of those great power forwards that you mentioned. But what I will say is she is incredibly athletic, just incredibly good offensive rebounder. The number of points that she gets for USC on her putbacks is just astounding, and how well she boxes out and clears out her space in the lane. Really, really impressive. And defensively, I think she's done a good job of, you know, having to defend more out on the perimeter and still, you know, being that rim protector. I thought most of the defensive impact on Stanford was a result of Cameron Brink last year, but, you know, Kiki has shown that she was a big part of it, and has been very productive for a dominant USC defense. So I think a lot of the physical tools are still there. You know, I wouldn't necessarily like be asking for her to go to the fadeaway, like if he's calling her that often, or, you know, she's still very reluctant, I think, to take three pointers, but that's become, you can see like the form, it's something that she's working on. And as she gets more time, like, because you realize like this is basically her second season, like playing full time, right? You know, she was a bench warmer her first season at Stanford and like was a starter, but like kind of only a starter in name only at Stanford during her second season, because Tara really went with Haley Jones as power forward more often than not. So I have a lot of faith in her potential for development. I just think I wouldn't necessarily like bank on her ever being a number one offensive option. And that's kind of what like those other players, like their skill sets are that he's not yet.
All right, I wanted to talk about Unrivaled before we let you go. I find Unrivaled to be fascinating, not only just from the basketball experience, but from the marketing of the game and of the players' experience. And I started to think about this as I was watching the one-on-one tournament that is still ongoing. By the way, I thought there's going to be some fights in that tournament. They were going hard. As a more recent viewer of the WNBA, I sometimes feel like the marketing of the league could be a little bit better. And as I watch Unrivaled, I kind of wonder if the WNBA could learn some lessons from Unrivaled in being able to put the faces out there more, being able to put a little bit more of the individual personalities out there more, and to embrace that, because that's the part of the league that I like the most, is like, I like seeing who these women are and maybe getting to know them a little bit more. Obviously there's less people on the court, so you can focus on them a little bit more, and it's a lot looser. The announcing is a lot looser as well, but it just seems like Unrivaled is more of a showcase of the players rather than a showcase of the league itself. And it's obviously flipped for on the WNBA side. Mm-hmm. But do you see anything from Unrivaled that you would like to see the WNBA kind of bring over to their league?
I mean, I'm sure the players would say like amenities, money, you know, those are the things.
Absolutely.
the ease of watching is definitely part of it. Like I've been watching just everything on HBO Max, and it's just supremely easy to use and easy to find, and it's always right there at the top of my, you know, feed when I pull up the app. So that's nice. You know, I hear the WNBA marketing question a lot, and I guess as somebody who like just abhors like the idea of marketing myself and like the, you know, the whole idea of it, I don't know, to me it just seems like it's easier and Unrivaled to get to know the players because there are so many fewer of them, and
sure,
like we have this, you already know like who Nafisa Collier is, right? Like we already know who Brianna Stewart is. People who are coming in like kind of have those entry points already. And when there's only three people on the court at one time, like it's just easier to zone in on anyone. Like it's, as a fan, I think it's easier to consume that product than it is the WNBA or other 5-on-5 and fewer teams, right? So like you can just get in and feel like you know everything already. And like you're a, like an active, like educated consumer off the jump, and it's just harder with a bigger league and more players. So I think that's an inherent advantage to the league. I do think just like the way that they promoted the players is great though. Like the little cards they had, you know, with like their nicknames on, and was really smart, and that they have the one-on-one option where like you literally get to see the player highlighted by herself, just adds to that. But I do think I'm with you that like the WNBA could probably learn a couple things, and just in terms of how to make it so that like everybody's focused on the one player. Like we're not focusing on any of the side stuff, right? Like I haven't heard anything about petty nonsense happening at Unrivaled or like, you know, like I know that there have been complaints, like, you know, Ryan Howard was like retweeting a bunch of fans who said like it was rigged against everybody but the Lunar Owls. And, but like, we're not leaning into that, right? Like everybody's just talking about the basketball and the games. And I think the focus being so clearly on the experience of the players itself and like the product itself has really helped, because the WNBA in my opinion, has tried so hard to be a league that like does everything, that encompasses everything. And I understand that the players like think of themselves as more than athletes, but when you're marketing a basketball product, I feel like it's just best to focus on the basketball.
And Brad, I'll let you actually close this down, but I wanted to have one follow-up with this, which is you mentioned the Max and Warner Brothers Discovery, obviously. The idea of the whole league being on one channel and it's the one focus, like, because Warner Brothers Discovery does have the NBA, but they don't have as many sports as like ESPN. So it almost feels like on ESPN, the WNBA is like, I don't know, the fourth or the fifth or the sixth or whatever most important sport. And you can focus more on WBD and Max and TNT because there's just not a lot of competition. We're out of college football season. Mm-hmm. They don't have baseball until the playoffs. So it's just kind of a good focus. And on Max, you're right. You just see those games come up. And I know the new television deals, there's still like three different, how many are there three different networks that are going to be involved?
So I think they've only, so they announced the partnership with ESPN, NBC and Amazon, right? So those three properties. Yeah.
So,
and potentially like CBS could still be added to that, honestly.
And that's how you get money, is you have all of these people wanting pieces of it and competing against each other. So I don't fault them for that at all. Yeah, that's what the NBA did to get this record deal. But it is like having that focus by the one channel, it does make it feel a little bit more special. And so that's what I also like about it. And I do wonder if, you know, ESPN obviously has everyone knows that as the sports outlet, and they do have their own over-the-top service coming out sometime this year. So I'm sure there will be some WNBA focus there, but it just seems sometimes like the WNBA gets lost in the shuffle a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly valid point. But it's just, I guess, with a limited amount of inventory that Unrivaled's working with, right? Like it's easier to have one partner who can carry all of it. So I guess I can't fault the W in that sense. Like ESPN, I think, has been mostly a good partner in terms of promoting women's basketball. But yeah, there are definitely some advantages to being a smaller league that Unrivaled has really optimized. And I, as much as I would want the WNBA to take those lessons, I don't know how many of them are totally applicable when your league is six times the size, right?
I'm also just into startups because that's my career. So I love startups. All right, Brad, go ahead.
Okay, thank you again so much for your time. I have so many more questions, but I'll keep it to one. There's a big game tonight in Southern California. So I guess two-parted question. One, are you going? And two, is there any like thing you can say for USC that they have the smallest chance to beat UCLA, or do you think there's no chance?
Yeah, so despite the fact that it is heavily raining in Southern California, which you know for us Southern Californians is basically an invitation to stay in all day, I will be going to the game. And I would say that last season when USC was successful against UCLA, and admittedly these are two very different teams, Charisma Osborne was the number one defender on Juju Watkins, basically mirrored her the entire game. And I don't think UCLA has a specific perimeter defensive stopper in that vein, you know, who can handle the Juju Watkins assignment. So it's going to be some Kiki Rice. It's going to be some Gabriela Jaquez. You're going to see some Lena Arnasalo off the bench, probably. Maybe they'll even like switch some fours onto her, get a little Janiyah Barker time, you know, but I don't know that they have one defender who they can just say like, all right, you're on Juju for the whole game. You're going to match her minutes. Like this is just what we're going to do. And so maybe Juju finds some openings that way because none of them are the exact type of defender that Charisma Osborne is. And, you know, if the Bruins start London Jones, which they have been over recent games, like she is significantly smaller than Juju. And if Juju just starts hunting in on that matchup, that could be problematic for UCLA. So that really is what I'm just keying in right now, because like last year, I thought they defended Lauren Betts really well inside, but Lauren is just dramatically better than she was last year. And I don't think she's going to be as easily phased by a little bit of pressure from Rhea Marshall and Kiki Arifan, especially since she and Kiki were teammates back in the day, right? Like they know each other's tendencies a little bit, but I would say that the Juju matchup, really just like who on UCLA is going to be able to defend this? Are they going to have to throw a lot of defenders at her? Is Juju going to be able to make the right reads out of those doubles, or is she going to try to drive into traffic, right? Like what sort of happens there? And if she gets going early, which has been a struggle of late. Like she started a couple games like 0-8, 0-10 recently. That's to me, like, it seems like so obvious to say, like, if Juju plays well, USC can play well. But I really think she's going to need like a 33-point kind of game to make this a winning effort for USC.
So I want to thank you again for doing this. And I have tried to train my athletic app to surface your articles and Chantel's articles and Ben's articles higher in my feed. And I'm doing a much better job at that because I'm reading everything that you all are writing. Like Zena says on the podcast about just keeping the conversation about women's basketball going. Last year, when it came to the tournament, we had, I don't know if we actually had a men's pool, but I created the women's March Madness pool for our company. So I'm doing my part of the job to keep that conversation going. But outside of the Athletic, and you know, subscribe to the Athletic. If people aren't subscribed to the Athletic, it's tough because that's where a lot of the best sports content is. I think you're a blue sky person versus a Twitter person.
I'm a blue sky person. Yes, that's correct.
So people can find you on blue sky at, let me see. Are you just under your name?
Sabrina. I think you can just search my name, but it's Sabrina JM is the handle.
So you can find Sabrina's posts. Have we determined what it is?
I just say posts. I think like the term a skeet has been used.
To me,
post is really what I like to go with. Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to make people aware about how they can support you?
No, I mean that the Athletic, the writing, and the Athletic women's basketball show, which, stay tuned for potential little rebrand heading into the NCAA tournament, should be kind of fun. But that's nice. Where all my work is. And thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk Golden State Valkyries.
Yes. And I guess last prediction, if you were to choose now, who's your national champion?
Oh, my national champion. Okay. I'm going to go Notre Dame.
I was thinking about
nice.
That too.
I think that's the UCLA and Notre Dame. That'd be the dream game.
It would be really fun to get that matchup. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you to Sabrina, also for Brian. I am Double G. We will see you when we see you. Peace out.
Running an online business requires passion, knowledge, and a lot of dedication. Adding the complexities of setting up and managing hosting for your website piles on more work when you already have so many plates spinning. Whether you manage one WordPress website or dozens, Kinsta's managed solutions give you access to a platform that's optimized for the fastest speed, has enterprise-grade security features, and is powered by an intuitive custom dashboard with everything you need to manage your sites efficiently. Plus, Kinsta provides human-only WordPress expert support, which is available 24/7, 365, to assist with even the most complex sites. Forget frustrating AI chatbots. Kinsta gives you complete peace of mind by ensuring that your WordPress sites are always online, secure, and performing at their best. Start your journey with Kinsta today and get your first month free. Don't have time to migrate your site? Kinsta takes care of everything for you. Learn more at kinsta.com/podcast. That's KINSTA.com/podcast.